From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. For a few years in the 1950s, America's children were obsessed with coonskin caps, toy rifles, and Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. Walt Disney brought Davy Crockett back to life on his Disneyland TV show in the person of a virtually unknown actor named Fess Parker. Fess Parker went on to portray Daniel Boone on NBC for many years, guaranteeing that Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett would forever be confused in my mind. They both wore coonskin caps, and they were both Fess Parker. My guest this week is William Arch America. He's an expert on Davy Crockett and the Alamo, and on Fess Parker. In fact, his latest book is the very engaging biography, Fess Parker, TV's Frontier Hero. William Arch America, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, howdy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you knew Fess Parker. How did you meet him?
Of course, like millions of baby boomers, I met him on television back in December of 1954. But I actually met Fess Parker, the actor, in the summer of 1987 when he was in San Antonio, Texas. Of course, ironically, the place where Davy Crockett died in 1836 at the Alamo.
Well, what was the difference? When you met Fess Parker, were you disappointed that he wasn't wearing a coonskin cap and fringy leather?
I remember a friend of mine from the Alamo Foundation at the time, Gary Foreman, invited me to go to the airport with him to pick Fess up to bring him downtown to his hotel. And, of course, when I was standing at the carousel waiting for his luggage to arrive, he eventually came within sight, and I'm expecting to see coonskin cap, rifle, buckskin clothing, fringe, moccasins, the whole bit, as if it was 1954 or 55 again. But here comes this big guy in cowboy boots with a seersucker jacket carrying a tennis racket. So I had this little cultural shock, but then again, when I approached him, I'm 6'2", he towered over me, and once again, my vision of my childhood hero was strengthened by simply his physical presence and that wonderful smile of his.
So what kind of a guy was he?
He was the same guy that he was as Davy Crockett and as Daniel Boone.
He was a man, a big man.
Indeed, in so many ways. As chronicled in the book, the biography of Fess, Fess Parker, TV's Frontier Hero, many of the people, especially in the final chapters, who comment on him have this one, consistent thread of observation about his character and the way he carried himself throughout his entire life. And that's one of the great things about Fess, is that he was a unique man on screen, and he carried those same kind of qualities of courage and determination and honesty into real life.
Now, one of the fascinating stories in your book, which is full of fascinating stories, is how James Arness almost got Fess Parker's part.
Oh, indeed. We go back to 1954, and Walt Disney is preparing a number of projects, including a project on his forthcoming television program, Disneyland, which is going to coincide with his theme park a year later. He's looking for someone, and the tip that came to him was, see this guy, Jim Arness, he's been around for a few years, a big guy, and he's appearing as an FBI agent in a new science fiction thriller called Them, about giant ants who got that way because of radioactivity in the Southwest. Well, a few of the Disney people, especially Tom Blackburn, who was going to write the script, is sitting in this screening room, and they're looking at the movie, and there's, Jim Arness playing, I think Robert Graham was his character's name, in the film. And then there's a short little scene where everyone is supposed to report anything they see about UFOs, any kind of a report. And there's one guy called Alan Crotty, who was a Texas airplane rancher, and he's being detained because he said he saw something. And the scene is played with Jim Arness in this mental institution where Alan Crotty, played by Fess Parker has this wonderful scene, and at that moment, Tom Blackburn, who's sitting in the screening room, is going, "That's our Davy Crockett, not Jim Arness." And they tried to contact the projectionist where they got the print from. It was actually from Arness's agent. And they tracked down Fess and invited him in for a preliminary interview before meeting with Mr. Disney, as Fess always called him.
Well, was there ever any hard feelings there? I mean, it worked out great for James Arness, because if he were doing Davy Crockett, he probably would never have been Marshall Dillon.
Correct. With a long, great run, and of course, John Wayne is there at the very first episode of Gunsmoke, introducing the TV world to Jim Arness.
Yeah. All right, so, you know, it's interesting, I think, you know, because I think possibly young people today don't know anything about Fess Parker. They never heard of him, and they don't know Davy Boone or Daniel Crockett. But people from our generation, boy, it was a phenomenon, an incredible phenomenon, as you detail in your book. How did it all come about?
Not by a planned strategy by the Disney folks, that's for sure. Originally, there were going to be three TV episodes in television's first trilogy, first miniseries, Davy Crockett Indian Fighter in December of 54. Davy Crockett goes to Congress the next January, and Davy Crockett at the Alamo February 23rd, 1955. And after the very first episode, there was a groundswell of interest from all the little kids across the United States about this new TV hero. We have to remember that back then, across the United States, there were only three major stations, and ABC was the new kid on the block with a couple of local stations. And I kind of believe that in the 1950s, it's the last decade, the last generation probably in history, where the family sat around an object. Originally, it was a fire for about 10 or 50,000 years. then came radio, and then television. I think once cable came around and other types of technological items, the family dispersed with the technology, and we no longer were that unit. So everybody saw this. And so what happens is, after the first episode, Disney back in Burbank starts getting phone calls from merchandisers saying, "Hey, where can I get a coonskin cap or a flintlock plastic rifle or moccasins?" There was no plan for that back in those days. So Disney authorized about 150 items, merchandising items, but because David Crockett was a real person from the 19th century, there was no copyright on him per se. So thousands of manufacturers came out with items to promote Crockett, and this Davy Crockett craze just emerged as a groundswell. And that's the greatest type of craze I think any merchandiser can have, when the people started. Not unlike today, where a film is coming out and the merchandising has been planned a year in advance. Quite a different scene back in the mid-1950s. And of course, what happens is once the initial three episodes were over, Disney had a problem. Davy Crockett dies at the Alamo. We can't bring him back because he's a real person. So Disney comes up with a wonderful idea about prequels, having two episodes about Crockett's life, kind of fictionalized, before his adventures in Congress and at the Alamo. That also increases the public attention and interest and enthusiasm for Crockett, and then Disney sends him out on a tour of the United States in the summer of 1955, which coincides, of course, with the opening of Disneyland in July of 55, and the phenomena is just incredible. If we can think about when the Beatles arrived in 64, and their subsequent visits in 65 and 66. If we can think about anything on that type of plane of interest, Elvis in 1956, what Fess Parker experienced in the United States and in England the following year and other countries in Europe really makes the Presley craze and Beatlemania seem close runner-ups to a real cultural phenomenon.
It's very fascinating, and you're saying that it happened not just in America and England, but in foreign-speaking languages as well?
Correct. There's the rest of the world has always been fascinated about the American West, about this giant frontier and all the stories, real and imaginary, that are associated with it. And clearly, that was a genuine interest from folks in other nations. But it also caught our attention, too. There was something unique about Fess Parker's Davy Crockett. He was not like familiar TV cowboys like Roy Rogers or Gene Autry or Hopalong Cassidy. This is a guy that wore different clothing. He's firing flintlock weapons. He's engaging in all kinds of action and activities that his counterparts that came before him on TV did not do. He was a thorough original.
So tell us then, you know, how did it affect Fess Parker the man? Did he become a gigantic egomaniac, and did he hire a fleet of staff to disinfect his microphone before he would speak?
The answer to all those questions and comments and observations is no. He did, of course, find himself in a unique position. His original contract that he signed in the first week of August of 1954 promised him $550 a week with guaranteed 5 weeks' work with some options later on. Because of his immense popularity, in 1956, 2 years later, he hired another agent, Ray Stark, who got him $1,000 a week. It seems like a lot, and clearly $1,000 a week is a lot of money in 1956, but compared to the income that he was generating for Disney, he was really underpaid.
Well, Disney was kind of famous for that, right?
Yes, I think some of Fess's friends said that Disney paid all his actors, whether they were animated or real, the same amount of money.
And, of course, I don't think he ever got any residuals, or did he?
No, the only thing that he really got a part of, or was supposed to, he was supposed to get 10% of all the official Disney-licensed merchandising.
Mm.
And although he did gain a few hundred thousand dollars about that, he felt that he never really got his full amount, and I assisted him about a decade ago in trying to track down all of the merchandise and trying to get an accounting figure about that, but the records at Disney were incomplete. They believed that he was compensated. And that's the unique story about Fess and Disney. He was so appreciative of the opportunity. You know, he could never thank Mr. Disney enough, but of course he was also kept. While under contract, he was denied certain opportunities where he could have acted outside the studio as other actors were allowed to. He was not allowed an opportunity to co-star with John Wayne in The Searchers. He was not given an opportunity to appear in the film Bus Stop with Marilyn Monroe. So eventually in time, his roles in various Disney productions were getting smaller and smaller, Westward Ho, The Wagons, and Light in the Forest. And by the time Tonka was offered to him, he basically got out of that and left the Disney family. Although he kept in contact with the Disney Corporation every year of his life and appeared at numerous events at the park, whether he was putting his hands to be placed in cement, he was given a Disney Legend Award. He was given a wonderful featured window in Frontierland at Disneyland. His wines are still sold at Walt Disney World and at Epcot. So it was a very unique relationship between Fess and Walt Disney.
But we're talking with William Chimerka, and his latest book is called Fess Parker, TV's Frontier Hero. I think probably not only was Fess Parker in the first miniseries, but I think he was in the first movie that had previously been shown on television. How do you put it that way? I mean, it was on TV and then it was in the movies.
Right, and a lot of people think that Walt Disney thought, wow, we've got these three episodes and now we can exploit them as a motion picture. But in Fess's original contract, excuse me, there is a provision in there about the three Davy Crockett episodes being made into a feature film. So even Disney had the foresight of this. And that's the incredible thing. Here are the three episodes, and they've been re-released in the spring of 1955. Disney takes the original 3-hour-long episodes, edits them down to a 93-minute feature theatrical film, releases it nationwide in late May of 55, as most of the kids in American schools are coming out of their classroom for the summertime. So it was a big hit for the under 12 crowd in 1955.
And, of course, Fess Parker, you're mentioning some of the other films he made with Disney, but he kind of has almost a guest starring role in the great Old Yeller.
Correct. As Jim Coates, here he is. He's one of the stars of the film, but basically his character is simply away from home while this goes on, but comes back at the end and, you know, provides some very important family philosophy to his son about the death of the dog. Old Yeller remains one of the great emotional, tear-jerking films of all time.
I'm a little upset now, just thinking about it. No, I'm okay. I'm all right. No, don't worry.
Well, we get the Alamo fans, we get the same way when we see Fess Parker swinging Old Betsy in the final episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, and you're an expert on this, so tell us, how historically accurate or inaccurate were the films?
Disney, we tend to think that, you know, Disney is targeting this for youngsters, but Disney never made anything exclusively for kids. He made all his productions for children and their parents and relatives and grandparents to see and enjoy together. Clearly, there are a number of items that are embellished in the three episodes, but it does treat them generally correct. Crockett is a volunteer in the Creek Indian War of 1813-14. He is a backwoods politician who eventually is elected to the Tennessee State Legislature. He eventually serves 3 terms in Congress. He does take a tour of the northeastern states in 1834, and he does go and fight for Texas independence and dies at the Alamo.
Did he wear a coonskin cap? That's the question.
When he left Memphis, Tennessee, in the autumn of 1835, there is an account of someone who says they saw him with his coonskin cap. On the morning of March 6, 1836, Susanna Dickinson, the only Anglo woman who survived the Battle of the Alamo, she's the only Anglo woman there, she said she saw his peculiar cap lying by his side. So we do have 2 pieces of contemporary evidence which suggest that. And, of course, animal skin caps are very common in the 18th and 19th century on the frontier.
In your book, Fess Parker, TV's Frontier Hero, you tell a sort of a funny story that there was a health scare about kids putting these coonskin caps on their heads.
Right. The Confidential magazine, as some of our listeners may remember, was the exploitation scandal magazine of its time. And it featured a story about the hazards of coonskin caps because, to an extent, their story wasn't true, but the story behind it was. That is, there came a point where the demand for raccoon tails was so great that other animals were used to make the caps.
Did they use rats?
I don't think so, but I think Confidential magazine suggested any type of mammal would do. But rabbits probably served a great purpose. I have a collection of hats from 1955, and there were never completely raccoon. Most of them were rabbit with a real raccoon tail. Some of them were so desperate that some manufacturers simply made them out of paper, and in fact, one company gave up on making them and simply made African pith helmets that said Davy Crockett on them.
All right, so Fess Parker played Davy Crockett for just a few years, and then they basically cloned Davy Crockett into Daniel Boone.
Correct. It's 1963, and Disney reissued the Davy Crockett series on the Wonderful World of Disney at the time, once again, it was very popular. And Fess Parker thought about reviving the Davy Crockett series, but Disney would not give him permission. His good friend Morgan Woodward may have given him the idea, and he said to Fess, well, how about, you know, Daniel Boone?
Yeah, he's got a song and a coonskin cap.
Yeah, so Fess developed a production idea and went to NBC and got it approved, and did a pilot, and that pilot was so successful that it turned out to be a run from 1964 to 1970 on NBC, 165 episodes.
That's quite a long run.
Mm-hmm.
And was the show popular?
Yes, especially in the last couple of seasons, it was a top 25 shows for one or two years.
Hmm.
Good enough for NBC to keep it on. And then just by a kind of production osmosis, evolutionary process, all the parties agreed it was time to end it and move on.
But although it wasn't the phenomenon that Davy Crockett had been, it was very popular with...
No. You know, how many bands have duplicated what the Beatles have done?
Well, there was Herman's Hermits.
Yes. You know, a number of British guys. I remember Peter Noon told me once that he did remember the Ballad of Davy Crockett growing up.
Yeah.
And he probably heard the Bill Hayes version, number one here. It was number two in Great Britain.
You have a whole chapter in your book that everybody will love. It's just devoted to all the different versions of the song and the various success that it's had.
Yeah, it's very difficult in this day and age to recall really the impact of a song being covered by so many artists. We can think back to April of 1964, when the Beatles had the top five tunes on the Billboard Hot 100, along with about a dozen others. But back then, with the Ballad of Davy Crockett, it was recorded by, you know, dozens of artists at the time. And four different artists, broke the Billboard top 20 with versions. And Fess Parker had one of them that had a top five version. Just incredible.
Well, Fess Parker just passed away a year or so ago.
Yes, on March 18th, 2010.
So how did he spend the rest of that long life after Daniel Boone?
Well, he did make a few other movies. He was in The Hangman in 1955, in 1959, and The Jayhawkers in 1959. He also made an uncredited appearance as Davy Crockett in the Bob Hope comedy Alias Jesse James.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, he was Sergeant Pike in Hell is for Heroes in 1962, a movie which ran out of money. And if you ever get a chance to see the movie again, Hell is for Heroes ends as the camera zooms in kind of awkwardly on this German bunker, and it just ends. And Fess always lamented that because his biggest, most dramatic scenes were coming next in the movie. He appeared in a Smokey...
Oh, yeah, Smokey the Cow Horse.
Yeah, in 1966. And then he appeared in a TV movie, Climb an Angry Mountain, in 1972. He did have a few feelers go toward him. People wanted him to be McLeod on TV. And also he had a pilot, The Fess Parker Show, in 1974, which had one pilot, and it ran just once. And after that, Fess said, that's it. He was looking for other things to do.
And what were those other things?
Those other things primarily were real estate. His son Eli always said that his dad had a great ear, eye, nose, and feel for dirt. I think the big thing would be in 1987 when he purchased some property in Los Olivos and started the Fess Parker Winery.
Oh, yeah. So tell us about the winery.
The winery is just another one of his projects. Fess was always a guy who was looking to do something, to develop something, an idea, a story, a screenplay, a piece of real estate. The Doubletree, Fess Parker Doubletree in Santa Barbara, of course, is a visible, you know, manifestation of a project that he wanted done. But the winery was something special because it would involve his children and subsequently his grandchildren, that it would be a family-run business and that it would be beneficial to all who participated. And it has. He planted his first grapes in 89, he planted some Riesling, and then developed some very good wines. He's broken 90, which is the big line for Wine Spectator folks, courtesy of Robert Parker, no relation. Fess's favorite wine was his Syrah, even though his wife, Marcy, preferred the Pinot Noir. And you can get one of the best wines they've ever made as a special wine that's available right now, simply called Crockett.
Tastes like a coonskin cap? No.
It's a very elegant bottle. He, of course, he does have his, the key thing on his labels, there is a very small, very distinguished, very low-key and very elegant coonskin cap. On his Parker Station brand, there's a face of a raccoon. And, of course, on Frontier Red, there's a picture of him as Daniel Boone. So Boone and Crockett live on in his wines.
Well, this book, Fess Parker, TV's Frontier Hero, is kind of a culmination of a lot of work for you. I know you've written other books, but Fess Parker worked with you on the writing of this book.
Only indirectly. I approached him years ago, and I said, you know, I'd love to write a biography about you. And he said, well, you know, I'm really not interested, meaning that he thought no one would have an interest in him because his narcissism was at a very low level. I said I would help him with his autobiography. He refused. I said, look, how about I lead an effort to let you get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame? And he said, well, I don't like the idea of people walking all over me all day long, Bill, but thanks anyway. That was simply his style. So, you know, he didn't want one done while he was alive. So what I was going to do in the interim, I was going to do a 50-year anniversary book on the Davy Crockett craze in 2005, but Disney was not interested in it. So I, you know, said, oh, well, that's too bad. And then, of course, as Fess was getting more seriously ill, I realized that perhaps I could do something after he passed. And with the support of his children, Eli and Ashley, and his very good friend and lawyer, Chuck Bargill, I undertook the effort, and I wanted to, you know, get this done as quickly as possible to get it out by his birthday, which was August of 2010. Of course, haste, you know, makes a little waste at times, but I wanted to get this initial version out just to honor this great man.
Well, it's a wonderful book. I enjoyed it very much. It's called Fess Parker, TV's Frontier Hero, and the author, William R. Chimerka. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It is my pleasure. As Davy Crockett would say, be always sure you're right, then go ahead.
That closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see me again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, William R. Chimerka, author of Fess Parker, TV's Frontier Hero. The production of From the Bookshelf is aided and abetted by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.